In the grim darkness of the far future, life in the Imperium of Man is not measured in comfort or happiness. For the billions who till fields, toil in factories, or pray in cathedrals, every day is a struggle under the crushing weight of war and bureaucracy. Ordinary citizens are taught from birth that their existence is service to the God Emperor, whether feeding his armies, fueling his navy, or worshipping at his holy shrines. Faith is the only reprieve. Work is endless, and the threats of aliens and demons are never far from mind. Even in times of relative peace, news of distant wars or plague fleets reminds every subject that safety is an illusion. In the Imperium, there is only service and obedience, and the small comfort of believing the Emperor is watching it all. This account follows no heroes or spacefaring adventurers, but the faceless millions of ordinary men and women, the factory worker sweating in the forges, the farmer praying for rain in endless fields, the scribe buried under data slates, the humble pilgrim kissing relics in the imperial cathedrals. Across hive cities, forge worlds, agri worlds, shrine worlds, and everywhere in between, their lives are shaped by sacrifice, faith, and the ever-present pressure of the Imperium's needs. Hive worlds, spires of squalor and industry. Hive worlds are vast megalopolises built skyward in a hellish monument to industry. Tens of millions, sometimes billions, crowd into arcologies so tall they blot out the sky. The gilded upper spires house nobles and factory bosses in protective manses of steel and glass, safe from most dangers. But for the great majority, life in the hive is squalid and perilous. The air is thick with soot, recycled so many times that each breath is a gamble with disease. Water is distilled from filthy runoff, and food takes the form of tasteless nutrient paste or gruel. Children grow up with ash in their lungs and hunger in their bellies. In the depths of the hive, where sunlight is forgotten, humanity lives hand to mouth. Whole families may sleep in a single windowless cubicle, and communal latrines are cleared only when the Arbites order it. Disease like hive fever ravages the underhive, with primitive medicine pitifully scarce. Gangs and cults carve out territory among the tangled lower levels, becoming de facto law and shadowy arbiter of justice. Knives flash and chainswords growl in dim corridors as underhive bosses enforce their own brutal order. Rumor has it that some cultists even wear imperial icons to mock or ward off rivals. Despite the filth and violence, hive worlds are the Imperium's armories. These worlds churn out weapons and tanks, tanks and ammunition. Endless factories sprawl across the platforms. At any hour, the hiss of molten metal and the clank of assembly lines drown out human voices. Men and women stand at these assembly lines by the millions, feeding raw materials into great machines, praying only that their day's work meets the crippling quotas. Production is a sacred ritual. Workers are given medals or scarred with icons of the Emperor for meeting quotas and punished, sometimes with immediate execution or servitor conversion, for failing them. The only respite for hive dwellers is duty beyond their walls. 1 in 10 youths may be taken into the Astra Militarum or other arms, promised a meal and a purpose. Those who stay behind cling to hope or cynical humor. A cramped hut one could call home might plaster torn posters of lost comrades or saints, as people bless the Emperor's name for every next breath. In the end, hive world citizens live with two harsh truths. The machines they power protect humanity, but they themselves will never taste its fruits. Forge. Worlds are the beating metallurgical hearts of the Imperium, planets utterly consumed by factories and forges. On these worlds, nearly every soul is born to labor beneath the Adeptus Mechanicus. Endless river of lava from blast furnaces snakes between cities, and mountain-sized inductors belch plumes day and night. Conveyor belts stretch as far as the eye can see, ferrying gears, tanks, starship parts, and arcane relics of lost technology. The sun is often a pale disk behind ashen smoke. Light for the people comes mostly from the glow of red-hot iron and hololithic projectors. Children on forge worlds live to work machines. Boys and girls learn the machine. God's catechism before they learn to read. How to placate a groaning engine. How to calibrate a servo cog by prayerful ritual. How to sacrifice a mistake to the omniscia through self-discipline. Failure is heresy. A single defective batch of ammo or a misaligned plasma conduit can be attributed to offending the machine god, and the tech priest responsible will answer for it. Many workers prize strict efficiency with religious zeal. A slow smith might end up volunteered for a tech priest job, surgically augmented with extra limbs and cognitive implants. A gift and a curse from the Mechanicum. Life on a forge world is grim. Vast industrial arches stretch for miles, their walkways perpetually shadowed. The air is no less rancid than in the hive. Chemical fumes swirl from every pit and refinery, and respirators are common. Fortified rations arrive at predetermined intervals. One might receive a packet of protein cubes, flavored, if fortunate, with a hint of spice, or a nutrient paste thick as motor oil. For many, even a sip of water is precious. Aquifers are often contaminated or siphoned off. If one factory worker is lucky, he might work next to a cleric and get a blessing token that could later be sold for extra gruel. Even worship merges with industry here. On Forge Worlds, the Omnissiah, the machine god, is more immediate than the Emperor. Shrines to bellowing engines outnumber chapels to saints. Workers often whisper supplications to their tools before starting a shift, and armored magi perform rites before the plunging of new reactors. A glitching servitor might be dragged into a foundry temple for exorcism, or at least a seasoned tech priest mutters a quick benediction over its coils. And why not? The distinction between spiritual and profane is thin. A functioning gear is holy, a broken one profane. Yet for all their might, forge worlds are isolated. No outsider, not even an inquisitor, walks among the factories unless armed with unquestioned mech-cog access. Data slates of ancient knowledge are hoarded in vaults. Citizens only get the scraps needed to do their job. So long as quotas are met, life here is stable, but quiet. Small trade quarters do exist. In the twilight hours, an old smith might carve a miniature iron crucible to sell, or a warehouse clerk might slink through a servoskull-lit stairwell to trade parts on the black market. These are dangerous pastimes, for the Mechanicum views all as sacred. Even scrap black markets get burned out. Forge World citizens accept this with passive pride. The machine god takes us, they might say, forges out doubt and makes us whole. In a way, they believe they have been chosen. Their ashes feed the arteries of civilization. That is some small comfort when you, a man of flesh and bone, wake each day to find yourself inching ever closer to becoming a scrap heap yourself. Agri worlds are the breadbaskets of the Imperium. Planets utterly dedicated to farming. Vast continents of cropland stretch beyond the horizon, divided into geometrical fields that feed millions. Some worlds graze enormous herds of Grawks and Taurus, gentle beast mutants whose meat sustains an army. Others harbor mile-wide plankton seas or fertile underground fungus warrens. Every waking hour here is defined by sowing, tending, and reaping. The machinery varies. Some farmers guide prehistoric plows through rich earth. Others pilot massive harvest crawlers in under-refrigerated canyons. Whether they tend agri-slabs under alien suns or hydroponic vats in biodomes, the task is the same. Grow food that will travel to distant stars. This diet, however, rarely reaches their own tables. Hard-working farm families often subsist on the scraps. Their children might wake to coarse gruel flavored with algae extract. Not the golden grain stores they see piled onto awaiting transport ships. If there is meat in a stew, it is usually boar gristle rather than cattle steak. On special feast days, they might taste something better. Perhaps a small slice of cured grok's knee, or a tangy fruit imported through religious connections. By then, though, nearly all of that fruit has been passed on as offerings to local shrines, or sent off as tithe. The overseers on agri-worlds are relentless. Notable ground controllers from the Adeptus Administratum might arrive in beetle-winged craft each harvest to audit yields. If a world's quotas fall even slightly short, officials might commandeer personal stocks or enlist extra farmers at bayonet point. Miscalculations and bad weather are treated as economic sins. Entire villages can be marked for punishment if they dare to say, "We have no more to give." The normal citizen learns quickly to keep thorough records and to smile grimly at tallies, trusting only in faith and the next sowing season. Even amid hardship, life on an agri-world is woven with faith. People believe the emperor and their patron saints in heaven share the burdens of each harvest. Fields are sometimes sown in the shapes of holy aquilas or saintly icons at the priest's instructions, so that the machines harvest the word of God itself. At planting, families might bow before a stylized plow. At reaping, they offer a portion of each field to the emperor's cult. Village elders claim these rituals coax the sun and rain just as much as any science. Theatrical festivals can arise around the cycle of growth. When a year's grain covers the fields, villagers might hoist banners and sing the anthem of the autumn harvest, because any event that saves one more mouth from starvation is worth celebrating. Not everyone stays to farm. When planetary governors issue conscription, strong-armed sons and daughters of farmers often enlist or are outright seized for the Imperial Guard. In return, they might be promised steady rations and purpose. The lucky ones experience a terrifying, disciplined life far from home. The rest are saluted off with a blessing and a handful of meal tokens. Those who remain seldom hear news of these recruits. "Better them than us," some farmers say. "We can watch the drought, they watch the bullets." Every day on an agri-world is drudgery beyond imagination. One joke their children share is that a farming child might pray to the emperor to sleep past dawn, if that was even allowed. They toil at midnight and dawn, sometimes in these long-range hydroponic bays lit by electric suns. Then they pray. If an imperious decree adds a new quota, they might find the statues of saints already being hoisted on their backs again. Yet they persevere. As one scarred plowright put it, "The field of the emperor feeds more than just the belly. It feeds the soul. If I starve, at least it was for a good purpose." Shrine, worlds are the spiritual heart of the Imperium. Planets consecrated to saints, martyrs, or miracles. On these worlds, faith is not just compulsory, it is woven into the very fabric of society. Imagine cities where every skyline is crowned with domes, spires, and towering statues of angels. Village greens host eternal flames and small ossuaries. Citizens walk by as if inside a vast open-air cathedral. Morning might begin with church bells or cathedral horns, and evening end with incense drifting from every block. Daily life here revolves around worship, Market stalls share space with confession booths and candlelit icon shrines. A farmer will first kiss a hand mirror blessed by a saint before he drives the tractor. A factory foreman sees the assembling of a laser gun as part of a procession and might offer a silent prayer for every weapon stamped with the Imperial Eagle. Children recite tales of the Emperor's deeds instead of fairy tales. Even criminals, if imprisoned at all, may be shown at least the Lord's Prayer, lest they carry hate in their hearts. Everything, from the legal system to leisure, is touched by devotion. The economy thrives on religion. Pilgrims arrive in their millions from all corners of the galaxy, spending credits on blessed candles, relics, and luxurious accommodations. Local inns, feasting halls, and relic engravers flourish. You might see a widow selling polished rocks she claims are miracle stones from a saint's tomb, or a merchant peddling loaves that have been blessed for fertility. Priesthoods take secret commissions, balancing the holy mandates with the practical need to keep citizens fed and entertained. Yet, as one devout poet notes over a muted organ, a sinner still buys his candle. Even paradise breeds corruption in shadow. Wherever wealth and faith gather, so do thieves and swindlers. The catacombs and backstreets of a shrine world are as dangerous as a hive's underbelly. Some criminals sell counterfeit holy relics, others smuggle banned scripture under the guise of pilgrimage. There are cultists among the faithful. An old smuggler might pose as a humble pilgrim with a badge, only to spirit heretical data slates to secret temples. Mothers on the streets warn their children that a meanderer in a white robe might carry more damnation than a lass pistol. Law enforcement is different, though stern, on these worlds. Instead of uniformed Arbites patrols, one sees Sisters of Battle or Adeptus Ministorum Inquisitors keeping vigil. They move among the faithful as angels of justice. Any heresy is met with a mix of prayer and bolter fire. Suspects are judged not only by imperial law, but by divine right. For example, a villager who blasphemes openly might be offered confession or sanctuary, a euphemism for being shipped off-world. If he persists, he might find his home sacred no longer, tossed among the alien shadow worlds. It's said on these worlds, better to be struck down by a warship's cannon than by the church's decree. Shrine world citizens accept this world of devotion. Their faith can be genuine. A sister of battle or a choir priest might actually smile with unshakable belief. And yet, some inwardly wonder if this devotion is the price of survival. They know they live on holy ground, but they also see each other's hypocrisy. On festival days, they watch a congregation's faces twisted in zeal and think about that pocket of rations stashed away. At night, they close their eyes, hoping that the Emperor is pleased with them, or at least has never noticed the fleeting doubts in their hearts. The Imperial Creed, Faith and Fanaticism. Across the Imperium, a single truth binds the populace. The Emperor is God. From childhood, every subject is indoctrinated with the Imperial Creed, the mandatory faith of humanity. Cathedrals and chapels dot every planet, always packed with worshippers. Religious iconography is everywhere. The double-headed eagle or flaming skull stamped on clothing, factory walls, even breakfast rations. Children memorize parables of saintly martyrs alongside the alphabet. The day's schedule is punctuated by ritual. Every factory shift opens with a prayer, every meal with thanks, every union meeting with slogans hailing the Emperor's mercy. Disobedience is treated as heresy. A missed prayer could become evidence of treason. But the creed is less comfort than obligation. For many, reciting liturgy is a matter of rote. A downtrodden peasant might know every litany by heart, not because he's a zealot, but because the last man who forgot had his crops confiscated, or worse. Disaster is always interpreted as divine judgment. A failed crop or a hailstorm may mean the emperor's wrath. People reflexively pray for bad omens to pass, because they know complaining might make things worse. In factories or fields, superstitions abound. No one wants to be the one who said, "It's fine," before the lightning strike. Theocratic law enforces the creed. Public dissent or malign thoughts are crimes punishable by confession, labor, or execution. A child drawing an unauthorized symbol in the street can be flagged as a cultist. On some worlds, every home is required to have a shrine, and dogs are even issued tiny sacramental collars to watch for possession. The wealthy might bribe inquisitors or claim a sudden illness to escape scrutiny. The poor have none of these luxuries. They learn to whisper quietly, to slap a pious smile on any countenance, and to nod yes to any sermon they hear, no matter how ugly the truth. In this bleak faith, the emperor is paradoxically both father and taskmaster. He is the one who will shield humanity from horrors beyond the stars, the one to whom every life is pledged. Yet, as emperor and god, he tolerates no weakness. The creed teaches that to live is to serve him, and that death is the ultimate gift. In sermons, you hear it said, "Blessed is the son who gives his life for the emperor." So the most fearful question a mother might ask over a thin supper is why her children must starve. Yet she dutifully prays it away as another sacrifice. In practice, the creed strengthens society at the cost of the individual. It binds millions into single purpose, devotion, unquestioning obedience. But it strips them of hope beyond salvation. To exist as a citizen is to accept that one's poor rations and fading memories are part of a divine plan beyond understanding. And faced with the horrors of the galaxy, who else can one truly rely on? Thus, every man and woman says his prayers, clinging to faith as both shield and yoke. Imperial justice is swift and absolute, proclaimed in the emperor's name by the Adeptus Arbites. These armored judges strike fear into every citizen. On any world, city or farm, an Arbites patrol might appear at dawn. Clad in black and white ceramite and a skull helmet, they arrest without question. Every man is presumed guilty until proven loyal. Minor infractions can be treated as treason, loitering after curfew, wearing the wrong ritual pattern on one's tunic, or even listening to foreign music could summon an interrogation droid. Trials are quick. Sometimes there are no trials at all, only the Arbite's verdict passed on the spot. For the rich and connected, injustice is often negotiated away. A nobleman might pay a bribe to make a lost case disappear or send a penitent offering to the shrine. But for the poor, the Arbites are final arbiters. A dust goat stolen to feed a child is just as likely a penalty as brandishing a slander. Punishments range from lashes and forced labor to execution by flame belt on the public square. If you are badgered by an Arbite, your fate is dictated by their iron code, and the emperor's law considers dissent itself blasphemy. They enforce authority to remind you that your life and death are his prerogative. Arbites' corruption is as obvious as their blood-stained robes. A farmer might slip a crate of his own grain onto a transport and pay it forward in coin rather than lose face. A factory boss might arrange for loud complaints to be heard by the bench when he simply wants troublesome foremen gone. But such bribery is beyond reach for most. A casual insult to an Arbite can land a miner in a slave pit. A whispered rumor about a rival can earn him a midnight knock. No one questions this system. To live is to know the Arbites are always watching. Families whisper stories about the black vans of Arbites that come at night. The worst fate is to simply vanish. friends learn not to speak a name out loud. In barracks, towns, and hives alike, cynics joke that the Imperial Guard are honored guests. But the Arbitus are nightmare hosts. The rule is clear. Personal property, personal rights, all belong to the Emperor. And the Arbites make sure that every subject remembers it. Among the most haunting sights in the Imperium are the servitors, mindless machines built from human flesh. These lumbering half-men, half-robots shuffle through factories, fields, and even cathedrals, carrying out repetitive tasks with blank eyes. A servitor might be a burdened farmhand with a retractor arm, or a factory worker whose skull is wired to a heavy welding rig. Others stand guard in clerical offices with cybernetic bolters grafted to their arms. They walk or even run, but they do not live. Any personality they had has been drained away, leaving only protocol. Servitors are created by the Mechanicus, or by order of the Arbites, from criminals and heretics sentenced to never-ending duty. A technician who questions a sacred schema, a citizen caught embezzling his rations, a fallen cultist. Any can return from the reprocessing bay as a servitor. News travels about who marched in as a man and came back as a machine, a 5-year technician, now a rusted field drone, a convicted Lord Inquisitor's nephew, now a lumbering combat servitor. The message to onlookers is clear and chilling. No one is safe from the Emperor's reclamation. Yet, servitors are everywhere, so commonplace that most simply accept them as part of the machinery of life. In a hive cantina, a servitor might quietly serve damp rations at the counter. On an agri-world, they plant and harvest at relentless pace. Even in temples, they appear, blazingly crooning prayers through vocal implants or shining incense coils in attendance. Citizens regard them with a mix of terror and awe. They are proof of the Emperor's will, undeniable and irreversible. Mothers hush their children and lead them away when stony red eyes of a duty servitor pass. Children sometimes blur the line. It is not uncommon to hear, "Finish your meal or you'll be next," during supper. To become a servitor is to have your soul offered as fuel for the Empire. The nearest comparison is a final re-education, a last purpose given to those broken beyond hope. Theoretically, it's a mercy. Better to be used than utterly discarded. But everyone knows a spirit ruined. Survivors treat servitors as the saddest of cautionary tales. Even loyal Imperial historians do not record whose life warmed that servo neck. Everyone knows that if they end up under those wires, they will work eternally. One nameless citizen once remarked, "At least the Emperor keeps his promises. Even after you are gone, you will still have a job." Education and indoctrination. Knowledge as dogma. True higher education is a rare privilege in the Imperium. For ordinary children, school is about learning to serve, not to question. Early lessons focus on the basics, reading, writing, arithmetic, but always in service of the Emperor. Children learn to decode laser schematic diagrams before they understand the wider galaxy. History classes are little more than engineering manuals and saintly biographies. One hand teaches them to maintain a las rifle. The other inscribes the life of Saint Celsus the Forged in their memories. Every subject taught ends with imperial piety. "All glory to the God Emperor," they must conclude. Curiosity is considered dangerous. A child asking why might be scolded out of exist. Only the gifted or connected receive anything beyond this. On hive worlds, elite academies exist, but they teach imperial law or propaganda, not philosophy. The highest scholars may train in the scholae of Adeptus Terra or Mars, where they devour forbidden knowledge. Those on agri worlds with ambition might join the administratum's scribal corps, crunching numbers for the harvest. but ordinary folk by adulthood know only their trade. A laborer can read an instruction manual for a lathe, but not the banned half of the page. A serf knows to follow blessed horoscopes in farming schedules, but not to explain climate. Propaganda fills the gaps. Aerial billboards and firing range posters preach loyalty. Creeds and oaths must be memorized, and any deviation can land you in a re-education camp, which is anywhere between a tortured interrogation or forced labor. There is no academic freedom, only the license to recite imperial myth. So most citizens end education knowing how to live in the Imperium, how to fear the Xenos, how to pray, how to salute and repeat. No Imperial teacher asks if their Emperor is just or if the galaxy could be better, and that silence carries the loudest message of all. Bread and corpses, food and scarcity. In a galaxy perpetually at war, food is nearly as vital a resource as ammunition, and often nearly as scarce. For most Imperial civilians, meals are designed to sustain rather than to delight. The poor line up for bland rations, compressed grain bars, algae soup, or cheap gruel made from proteins whose origins are government secret. Fresh fruit, vegetables, or real meat are virtually mythical except for the well-off. A factory worker might smile at a free ration packet called Blessing of the Field, which is usually a sliver of nutrient paste by any sensible definition. Kids sometimes whisper that the only thing that's fresh about their meals is the fear of tomorrow's quota. Corpses themselves become a source of food. On many hive worlds, the bodies of the deceased are processed into corpse starch, a nutrient mash scooped into loaves or slop. Necromunda's Corpse Guild, for instance, is entrusted with this grim task, grist to prevent the living from starving. Neighbors line up to respectfully offer their dead in hopes it spares their own lives a little longer. It's believed a life lived well might even find honor as grain to feed the many. Parents quietly tell their children that someday they too will be redistributed to feed others, as if it is a mercy rather than a necessity. Black markets flourish in desperation. On agri-worlds, hungry gangs might break into storage bunkers and sell stolen grain at half price. Hive underlings chop up vermin milk cheese, ferment sewer water, or risk death collecting rainwater in rusted barrels. In one case, a starving family laced a stew with spice from a Mechanicus lab to make it half palatable, only to be hauled away by Arbites for unsanctioned cooking. The rich behind palace walls eat as if no one else hungers. Cannon fodder on battlefronts joke that Imperial Guardsmen probably get better dinner rations than a frozen clinic patient back home. Throughout the Imperium, food is not an entitlement. It's a ration and a privilege, and often the tiniest flicker of hope. Citizens say a prayer before each bite, in case it needs divine permission to nourish. They turn every meal into ritual. Let this be enough to serve, they might whisper. When calamitous events happen, a crop blight, a convoy ambush, storehouses are emptied for military. Then the people in town eat the peas that have already been boiled twice. One grizzled colonist observed dryly, "The Emperor provides for someone," but he didn't say whom. The Emperor's tithe, taxes, and tribute. Above all else, every world's purpose is to pay the Emperor. The Imperial tithe is an abstract god bounding itself through ledgers, tribute that must be paid in men, material, or magic. Agri-worlds send grain and cattle, hive-worlds send manufactured goods and soldiers, even water and air are quantified and taxed if possible. Administratum tribunals pore over planetary returns like priests reading souls, ensuring nothing is hidden. If a harvest falters or a manufactorum produces less, the shortfall must be explained, reformulated, or replaced with human blood. A missed decimal can lead to planetary quarantines or worse. For the average citizen, the tithe is a living nightmare. Imagine a farmer who coaxed a bounty from the fields, only to watch half his harvest loaded onto warships. The small remainder is barely enough to keep his family alive. A factory worker might toil under sweltering heat to build 100 laser guns, only to receive in pay a 2-week supply of ration cubes. Fathers often send their few personal crops or savings directly to the administratum to avoid trouble. Mothers keep hidden stashes of grain so they can bribe local clerks for a warning if new levies are coming. But this is a scrap of security at best. Failure to meet any tithe is considered heresy. Rumor speaks of entire settlements erased for conspiring to eat the tithe. The only bureaucratic leniency is never guaranteed. One world might petition for relief during famine and see quotas halved, while another sees recruits carried off to starve to keep the figures up. The message is, the emperor has no shortage. Every piece of silver, ounce of fuel, number of troops belongs to him first and foremost. The cumulative effect is ruinous. Private ambition dies under the weight of tribute. What talent a person had is repurposed for the tithe. A good harvest or factory yield is not celebrated, it is calculated. When children dream, they dream not of luxury, but only of keeping some bread after taxes. At night, farmers might kiss the ground and whisper grudging thanks that it fed someone, rather than curse the ledger they never see. Living in a tithe-driven universe, many learn the sharp truth. To be useful is to give everything away, and yet cling to whatever scraps one can keep. A common lament goes quietly. We pay not for comfort, but for war. But war is also our salvation or our doom. Conclusion: the weight of existence. Across the Imperium's myriad worlds, civilian life is an endless cycle of obedience and endurance. The God Emperor demands every hour of every life in exchange for tiny mercies. Whether one stands amid the choking smog of a hive city, the infernal furnaces of a forge world, the endless fields of a farm planet, or the echoing cathedrals of a shrine world, the themes are the same: sacrifice, fear, and faith. Each person is but a cog in the Emperor's vast machine, baptized in hardship and bound by devotion. Yet even under this crushing yoke, humanity persists. Children still laugh in the morning sun of agrarian villages. Field hands still hum imperial hymns to calm their backs. Secret lovers still meet under starlight, too faint to reach the factories. Small acts of defiance or joy spark when least expected. A farmer might break into a smile over a healthy calf. A scribe might tuck a forbidden poem into the margins. A servitor might hum a fragment of a lullaby it no longer remembers. In these tiny moments, one sees the faint glimmer of hope, not in the Imperium's glory, but in the sheer persistence of the human spirit. The Emperor may claim every loaf and every life, but in the hearts of his children there remains something unclaimed. They endure, they pray, they work, and in their endurance they prove something of worth to the galaxy, that even in the face of endless war and tyranny, humanity refuses to be entirely extinguished. The quiet rebellion of simply living and caring for one another under the most brutal of circumstances might be the finest legacy of all in the 41st millennium.